Okay, this is the first in a series on the oral law. We're talking about the oral law for this week. I should just mention at the outset that the oral law is a section of a much larger body of material called the oral tradition, which contains within it a great deal more than just law. I'm restricting myself only to the legal portion. Another preliminary remark, the oral law is not a commentary on the written. If you want probably the most dangerous mistake packed into the fewest words, that's probably it. The oral law is a commentary on the written. It is nothing of the sort, although it contains pieces that are commentary. The vast majority of it is not commentary on anything. Furthermore, as we will see, the oral law contains within it materials of different origin, different levels of stringency, different types of authority. It's not one thing. It's a general category that has in it many different subcategories of information, and each one has to be understood on its own. In the broadest terms, one could divide the oral law into three dimensions. First of all, together with the written five books of Moses, which God dictated to Moses letter for letter, and was completed at the end of his life. Together with that, God dictated to Moses an enormous amount of oral information, which was not written in the five books of Moses, and which was preserved separately and independently. That's one part of the oral law, material that came directly from God to Moses. At the other extreme, there is in the oral law legislation that the rabbis created. Thank you very much. Legislation that the rabbis created not derived from the written in any direct sense at all, and its status has to be understood, what kind of authority it has, how stringent it is. Those are the two extremes on a spectrum, and they're the easy cases because they're pure. The first comes from God directly to Moses, and the second is something that the rabbis invent. In the middle, you have a much more subtle category where the rabbis interpret and apply materials that they received from Moses from God. Here, the material is hybrid. Its origin comes from God through Moses, just like the five books do. But its interpretation and its application is the result of the sage's judgment. And it's a whole discussion, a whole subject, what kind of authority that has, how that authority relates to the two extremes. So I will start today with the core that goes back to Moses, and then we'll work on the other two sections as time allows. Now, the first thing that I want to show you is that the existence of the core, going back to Moses, is demanded by the text itself. And it's demanded by the text itself in the following way, that if you try to take the laws as they are written in the text and apply them to a real community without any supplementation, just take what's written and live by it, you would not be able to do so. The written text as it stands cannot be put into practice. So that if one thinks that this text was ever used as legislation for people to live by, one must presume that there was accompanying material. So, for example, one of the ten pronouncements at Sinai is not to do melacha on Shabbos. That's repeated about 20 times in the Torah. It carries the death penalty. It's pretty important. Nowhere in the Torah is there a clue how to define the word melacha. What does it include and what does it exclude? Is signing your name a melacha, painting a picture, watering a plant, tearing down a house, is that a melacha? Sewing a stitch, striking a match? Now, the text makes it quite clear. If it prescribes capital punishment violation, it means that people are going to live with this and people are going to perform actions, witnesses will observe them, they'll be brought to the court, they'll be accused of the crime. If there's no definition of the key term, there's no way to do that. Another example, marriage. Marriage is very important. It triggers all sorts of responsibilities and prohibitions. Nowhere does the Torah define what counts as marriage. What do you have to do to be married? Nowhere does the Torah tell you what that is. Now, when it comes to divorce, we are very, very fortunate. We have one whole sentence. Torah says a divorce takes place when the husband writes a document of severance and puts it in the hand of his wife. A whole sentence. Of course, anyone with a practical mind will think of dozens of questions right away. What happens if the husband is illiterate? Does that mean he can't divorce his wife? What happens if his wife is an amputee, doesn't have hands? Can't divorce his wife? Suppose they're in different cities. Must he travel to the other city and hand it to her himself? Can he send a messenger? Can he send it by carrier pigeon? How about email? What about the document itself? Does it have to have any minimum text? Is bye-bye baby enough, or must it be a little more prolix, a little more elaborate? One sentence like that just creates dozens of questions about how to actually put it into practice. Then there's a ceremony in the fall. And for this ceremony, you have to use four plant species, one of which is described as Pri'etz Hadar. Pri'etz Hadar means a fruit of a beautiful tree. Or maybe it doesn't. Maybe it means a beautiful fruit from a tree. It's not clear whether the beautiful modifies fruit or modifies tree. That's all it says. Three words. Which one is that? A peach, a pear, a plum, a pomegranate, a Jaffa orange? Would you pick a citron? In the written text, you don't have a clue as to which fruit it is. Nevertheless, in the entire history of the Jewish people, no one has even suggested a peach, a pear, a plum, a pomegranate, or a cashew nut, or a grape, or any other fruit than a citron. Then perhaps the most dramatic, and this one Rashi actually comments on the spot, is Deuteronomy 12:21, which you can look at if you please. It's on page 1005. When we were in the wilderness for the 40 years, when we wanted to eat meat, the tabernacle was there. And what people did was to offer a sacrifice and take the portions that a person can eat. And that was how they ate meat. Whether it was legally required or not, it's a whole discussion, but that's what they did. Now, you're coming into the land of Israel. Well, it's a long trek from Tveria to Yerushalayim or to Shiloh. Are you allowed to have a barbecue in your backyard? Or must you make the trek when you want to eat meat? So the Torah addresses this. Verse 20, the top of the page. When Hashem your God will broaden your boundaries, he spoke to you and you say, I would eat meat, for you'll have a desire to eat meat. To your heart's entire desire may you eat meat. If the place that Hashem your God will choose to place his name will be far from you, you may slaughter from your cattle and your flocks that Hashem has given you, as I've commanded you, and you may eat in your cities according to your heart's entire desire. You don't have to go to the place where the tabernacle is standing or later where the temple was standing. You can have a barbecue in your backyard. There's only one little qualification. You may slaughter from your cattle, from your flocks that Hashem has given you, as I've commanded you. When you slaughter it as I've commanded you. Okay, the thoughtful reader says, gosh, there's some requirement here, there's some restriction. Slaughtering has to be done as he commanded me. Where did he command me? Now, you can search the five books of Moses or the rest of the Tanakh, the whole 1,000 pages. You won't find a clue how to slaughter animals. Nowhere. Not even a hint. So the reader of these words is expected to know what to do. If he's relying only on the book, there's no way for him to know what to do. Obviously, there was other information available to the reader that isn't written in the book. Yeah. Well, let me just draw my conclusion and then I'll answer your question. So now, I want it to be very clear what the conclusion here is. I've taken 6 examples. You could take 60 examples or 600 examples. This is by far the majority of legislation has this feature that many key terms are not defined and questions of application are not settled by the written text. Indeed, the laws of the sabbatical year, the Talmud already remarks that they're an exception. That all the details are written in the book, and that's exceptional, because it almost never happens. Now, what this argument proves is this, that whenever you think this book came into existence, whenever this book was used seriously as legislation for a community to live by, it could not have existed alone. We, who understand that the book was written by Moses, know that the oral information had to go back to Moses. I'm not fighting that battle now. As to when the book came into existence. Someone who thinks that it came into existence, that Ezra wrote it or something else, I'm not fighting that battle now. The only battle I'm fighting now is this. For a person to say, the book came into existence and it was used for hundreds of years, and hundreds of years later, people made up the oral tradition, that's incompetent. Because there must have been accompanying information from the time the book was first used as practical legislation. Now, we don't have, I think, enough information about the Sadducees to comment, but what happened with the Karaites is they started by denying the oral tradition, and very quickly they split into two groups, the majority of whom created their own oral tradition. Because, as we said, without some kind of oral tradition, you can't make it work. So then the claim was only that the rabbinic oral tradition is not the right oral tradition, and they somehow got the right one. But someone who's going to deny it altogether is going to be without ability to make the legislation work. And by the way, as you mentioned the Karaites, I myself was, I would say, overly generous to Karaite scholarship, and I had cause to rethink my opinion recently because I had the dealings with a Karaite. I assumed that since they believe in the written, that they would know the written well. And they disagree with the oral, and that's the big point of disagreement. But as a matter of fact, they're incompetent in the written as well. I was shocked to find. I went through their writings, and one claim they have is that the rabbinites, that's us, say there are two Torahs, a written and an oral, where nowhere in the entire Tanakh does the word Torah appear in the plural. Well, that's just wrong. It appears in Genesis, it appears in Leviticus, and it appears several times in the rest of Nach in the plural. It's just wrong. And the famous instance of they're not having fires in their houses on Shabbos, in the steppes of Russia, in the depths of winter, they froze because they didn't have fires in their houses. The Torah says, "Lo sevaru esh b'chol moshe zechem l'yom haShabbos." Don't be mevaer fire in your habitations on Shabbos. Now, I looked up in the concordance, the verb levaer in the Tanakh is ambiguous. Sometimes the subject of the verb levaer is a person firing a fire. Sometimes the subject of levaer is the fire, meaning the fire burning. Both forms are used in the Tanakh. If you wanted to say, don't have fires burning in your house on Shabbos, then the subject of the verb ought to be the fire. The fire shouldn't burn. But that's not what the verse says. The verse says, don't you fire in your houses on Shabbos. That means don't ignite fires. What you do to a fire is ignite it. You don't keep it burning, it burns all by itself, as I'm sure you all know. So, since the verb's subject is the people, not the fire, it has nothing to do with there being fire burning. So even in terms of the analysis of the written text, I was surprised to find that there's nothing solid over there. But at any rate, without it, either you invent your own, or you live with an impossibility to put it into practice the way it's written. Yeah.
Why does it have to be argued that they both came in at the same time, the oral and the written? Why can't you say, since obviously you can't use the written, then it must be that you were supposed to make something up. This is the general structure, and you're obviously supposed to fill in the gaps as time goes on.
Well, then time goes on. I didn't say where it came from. I said, I'm not fighting the battle now whether it came to Moses from God or not. All I'm saying is, at any time in which the book was used as practical legislation, there must have been extra information. You say it was made up? I don't mind. I'm just pointing out that the idea of the book operating on its own without extra information as a legal text for people to live by is not right. That's all I'm arguing. That couldn't be done. Okay. That being the case, how much, from our point of view, if God dictated the written text to Moses and was supposed to come into force right away, how much of the oral was given to Moses to supplement it? Well, at least as much as is necessary to put it into practice. But it doesn't follow that it's limited to that. It doesn't follow. It could have contained other material as well. Indeed, when the Talmud discusses a law, usually the first question is, where does it come from? Is it based on a particular verse? Based on a verse via a kind of derivation? A logical derivation? A derivation of Rabbi Yishmael's 13 rules, which is not logic? Or is it an oral tradition, going back to Moses? Or was it legislated some other time? Or is it an interpretation of a verse coming from a later time? That question is crucial to understanding the status of a law, and it is discussed in great detail, hundreds and hundreds of times in the Talmud. Now, it should be obvious, but I'll mention it anyway. This material, which came to Moses directly from God, orally, has as much authority, as much seriousness, as much validity, as much truth, as what's written in the text also. The fact that this was written, and this is oral, doesn't say anything about its authority. The authority is its origin, and the origin is that it came from God. So, when people say, people who don't understand our position, say, I understand why the written is of such seriousness to you and why you don't want to challenge the written. But the oral, why can't you challenge the oral? That's because they're assuming that the oral is made up by human beings. If you assume that, then indeed, at least it would be conceivable, one could talk about legal matters, intellectual matters, but it would be conceivable to challenge it. But when you talk at least about the core that came to God from to Moses from God, challenging that is no different from challenging thou shalt not kill, because the origin is what determines its status. Yeah.
Really, if you're saying that the status is as important as that of the written law and came about at least at the same time, why was it not written as well?
Okay, I will try to answer that, but let me, I'm glad you put it the way you did. I want to share with you something I heard from Shmuel Lin in Philadelphia a year ago, and I didn't have it clearly myself, and I think it's a good insight. Our picture of the process is this. Moses went up on Mount Sinai. He came down with what? Not the Torah that you put into the ark and cover with a mantle and take it out and read. The text of the Torah was finished 40 years later, just before he died. It says so in parts of Vayelech explicitly. He came down from the Torah with the commandments. So he came down from Sinai with the commandments. In fact, what we call the oral part was communicated first. And the written was written only later. The factual process is the exact opposite of what people imagine, and we have to struggle with their imagination, that the text existed and the oral was made up later. In fact, the oral was presented first, and the written was only finished and finalized and delivered later. Now, the question you're asking, why was But how was the division made between that which will be written and that should be left oral? That is a very, very fundamental question. To answer it, you'd have to have a complete picture of the entire written and the entire oral, so that you could distinguish somehow the themes, the dimensions, the emphases, and create a criteria which would determine what's written and what's oral. I don't know of anyone who has even attempted that. I don't know if anyone has even attempted that. It would be an intellectual challenge of immense proportions. So I really have nothing to say about that. But I will comment on the idea that some should be oral, that there should be an oral component altogether, rather than writing it all down. Aside from the impracticality of lugging the Talmud around on your camels in the desert, there are really two things here. On the surface, one important impact of having a large proportion of the material oral is that you can't learn it from books. You can only learn it from teachers. And that's important for two reasons. Number one, that the oral representing the heart of the Torah as a whole is supposed to be something which is restricted to the Jewish people. It's not supposed to be available to all and sundry equally. And number two, learning Torah is not an intellectual gesture. Learning Torah is spiritual, like everything else in Judaism. So that if you are under the tutelage of a teacher, of a master, who can monitor your spiritual development as you learn the material, then it can be truly a mitzvah. You're performing a mitzvah by God, to relate to God, to grow in your relationship with God. But if it's a book which you can absorb on your own, then the possibility exists for someone to absorb the material without ever coming in contact with a living teacher. And for this reason, when we started to write it down, about which we will speak about at great length, but I just want to point out, given that you asked the question, the writings for a long period of time were only a compromise with the oral status. The Mishnah cannot be understood as a compilation of the oral law, because it's written with missing pieces, it's written with contradictions built in, some subjects are mentioned only passingly in the most minor possible way. The Talmud is written in such a terse style. The Talmud is really, to a great extent, a record of conversations of experts on controversial, subtle topics. Now, you imagine, you know, there's a debate going on between the two top quantum mechanic physicists in the world, and you get a transcript of the debate. How much are you going to understand? They don't define all their terms. They don't, you know, but what about so-and-so's experiment in 1990? Yeah, but it was done again in 1992. Oh, yeah, I forgot. Which experiment is that? But what the experiment about? You know, what were the results? What happened in 1992? Well, if you don't know, you're not going to get it. So the Talmud also was written in such a way that it would have to be, the person has to be trained by a living master to be able to understand it. Only when you got to the codes was there a serious compromise with this, where the Maimonides was the first one to do this, where you have a book that's supposed to stand on its own. You can read it and at least get practically what you're supposed to do. And it caused a great deal of controversy. When Maimonides wrote the first code, it caused a great deal of controversy. Because people felt people are not going to invest in studying the Talmud anymore, and it'll be self-sufficient. Today, a great deal can be gotten from books, just from the books. I wouldn't say everything, but a great deal can be absorbed just from books, to the extent that the first English translation of the Mishnah was done by a Christian cleric living here in Yerushalayim, a fellow named Danby, and he did a pretty good job. He really did a pretty good job. He studied it as the antiquities of his own religion, and he went through the sources as best he could and got hold of dictionaries and looked up the relevant material, and he did a pretty good job. So it was not supposed to be like that. It was a compromise with his being forgotten. We'll talk about that in Yezus Hashem. But so that's one on one level. On a much deeper level, I'll just mention this to you so you should know that there are deeper levels. Chazal say, the Talmud says, that had there not been a golden calf, we would have received only the five books of Moses and the book of Joshua alone. Just those six. Which, by the way, is what the Samaritans have. And nothing else. And we would have been able to see what we call the oral in the written. But because we made the golden calf and we lost that level of insight, lost that level of penetration, so it has to be written all out to us. I'll give you a rough analogy. Imagine people who, a disease whereby everybody in the world goes colorblind. So now, you can put a spectrometer on a thing and you can say this wavelength is this wavelength and that wavelength is that wavelength, but that's just numbers. That's just the way in which the instrument responds. The fact that this is red and that's purple and that's green and that's blue is meaningless to you. It's just different shades of gray when you look at it. Right? You wouldn't be able to tell with your eyes all that information that you could have gotten when you had color vision. We lost our color vision. We no longer can see it in the six books. And therefore, the oral had to be given to us separately. So it wasn't supposed to be like that. Right? Well, originally, it was supposed to be that you could draw it out. Okay. Now, this oral material, as we said, has the same status in terms of authority as the written, but in terms of its legal, shall I say, the legal principles that can be applied to it, it's not equal. There are principles that are applied only to the written text. You have the 13 principles of Rabbi Yishmael, which can only be applied to a text, not to an idea, not to a rule, not to a law, but to a particular text. And since these don't have an official text, so that it cannot be done. Certain types of deductions can't be applied to this material, so that there are legal distinctions, but in terms of the authority is the same. How is this material that came to God, from God to Moses and then to us, how is it related to the written? So Rav Shanfel Hirsch has a very beautiful analogy. Imagine that you're taking a university course in a semester scheme, and you're in week 11. You listen to the lecture and you take notes. Someone who has not taken the course gets hold of your notes. How much of the lecture would he be able to reconstruct from your notes? If you're good at taking notes, the answer is next to nothing. First of all, by the time you get to the 11th week, there are certain code terms that you've learned. And when you write that code term for you, that stands for a whole concept and all sorts of applications. The reader is not going to know that. Imagine the professor starts saying something, and midway through the lecture, he modifies what he said before, and you underline one word. That to you means it's not what it was before. This is stressed, that's de-stressed. Someone reading is not going to know that. The point of the notes is for you who were at the lecture to be able to recall what you heard. Without what you heard, it doesn't carry information. Same is true here. The written is meant to be embedded in a background of the oral, and if it isn't embedded in the background of the oral, it won't be meaningful, and the oral is in no way an interpretation of the written. It's freestanding material, which you cannot derive from the written, and without which you can't understand the written. Now, that means, what I'm telling you now comes from Luzzatto's Essay on Fundamentals, the last five pages, which is absolute gold, and it deserves to be read at least 10 times. Not that the other things he wrote weren't gold, they're also gold, but this is very, very important. When the Talmud studies a law, and it says, Minohani Mili, where do these words come from? And it cites a verse. The naive, uneducated reader, which includes an awful lot, thinks the Talmud is deducing the law from the verse. The Talmud is proving the law from the verse. When one looks at the derivation, it just doesn't look like that. It just doesn't look very solid. It doesn't look very convincing. Often it looks very fanciful. The truth is, because most of the time it's not deducing the law. It's not deriving the law. It's not proving the law. That's not what it's doing. What it's doing is this. The laws are known independently from the oral tradition on their own. The verses we have in the book. And it's a matching exercise. An exercise of associating the laws with the verses. It's not a derivation, it's an association. Luzzatto proves this by the following observation. Very often you'll have in the Talmud a discussion that goes like this. One party says, I learned this law from verse A. The other party says, I learned the law from verse B. So the Talmud says, well, what does the first party do with verse B? He learns a different law. What does the second party do with verse A? There's a different law. Well then, where does the first party learn the second party's second law from? From another verse. And where does the second party learn the first party's second law from? From another verse. Well, what does he learn from that verse? Another law. And what does he learn from another verse? Another law. And they keep going back and forth, until we'll say that this party learned something from this verse, and the other one says, what you analyze in that verse, I don't believe that that's significant. So I didn't learn anything from it. And so on the other, and then it comes to a stop. Ask Luzzatto, how was the Talmud so sure that these moves are appropriate? The first one learns the first from the law from verse A. The second one learns from law B. So we say, what does the first one learn from verse B? Another law. Where does the second guy know that law from? Who says he agrees with it? Who says he agrees with that law? Since he's used up that verse for the first law, and the first person uses that verse for a second law, how do you know the second person agrees with that law altogether? Obviously, this whole discussion presupposes that they all have the same laws in common, and they all have the same verses in common, and what we're trying to do is match them up. We're trying to make an association between them. Many, many cases where the Talmud says, where is this law from? It's only a matter of association. It is not a matter of deduction. And therefore, if the association looks loose in terms of logic, it's meant to be that way. It's not meant to be a logical demonstration. Indeed, Maimonides, in his book on the commandments, the second root, he has 14 roots where he explains his methodology, the end of the second root says that this is an element of Jewish scholarship, to take items that are in the oral tradition and match them up with verses. Match them up, but not to derive them. Here's an example. There is a law that says capital punishment, normally, let me insert a footnote, every rule has exceptions. Every rule has exceptions. Every rabbinic rule that's in the Talmud, Seth literature has exceptions. Therefore, what I'm saying is not self-referentially refuting. Right? Every rule has exceptions. So when I say a rule, I don't mean it always works. Nothing works always. There are always exceptions. But the vast majority of the time, to execute someone for a crime requires that there be two witnesses that observe the crime, and someone must warn the criminal, what you're doing is forbidden and it carries capital punishment, and he has to answer, I know, and I'm doing it anyway. It's a very, very strict rule. It means capital punishment would be very rare. Imagine Joe wants a cigarette on Saturday. He takes out his cigarette, you know, and takes out the matches. And around the corner come Reuven and Shimon and say, oh, Joe, that's capital punishment. You know, you're breaking Shabbos. Now, if he really wants a cigarette, what's he going to do? He'll say, thanks for telling me, guys. Boy, it's wonderful that you're around. I just forgot. Have a nice day. And as they go around the corner, they're going to light up a cigarette. Why would he say, I know, I realize, it's capital punishment. You're watching me now. Watch. In your face. Here we go. And strike the match. Why would he do that? Not because he wants a cigarette, but because he wants to make an in-your-face demonstration that I don't care about the Torah, I'm breaking it. That's what capital punishment is for, basically. Not for the crime, the infraction itself, but for the choice to do it, knowing there are witnesses and being warned, and to do it anyway, that means you're not just doing it because you want it. It means you're doing it because you want the public demonstration of an anti-Torah act. Okay, that's the law. Where is there a verse that's related to that? Says the Talmud, there is a verse that says when a particular person commits a particular crime, he is subject to capital punishment, and the phraseology is Yomus Hames. The dead person shall die. Well, he shall he? The dead person shall die? What could that mean? You know, once he's dead, boys and girls. It doesn't have to be done twice. Not since I checked out these things. So they say, that's what that verse is related to. Ad sheyatir es atzmo lemitza, until he agrees to his own death. They say to him, you're going to die. Or they hear someone warning him, saying, you're going to die. And he says, I know, and I'm doing it anyway. Now, you could analyze those words, Yomus Hameis, the dead person shall die. You could analyze them now until the Mashiach comes. You will never be able to derive from those words that there has to be a warning, and he has to answer the warning, I know, and I'm doing it anyway. It's not a derivation. It's not a proof. It's not a demonstration. But I have all the verses on this side, and I have all the laws on this side. Here's this law that he's got to agree and say so. And here's this verse, the dead person shall die. There's no more plausible way, no plausible place to locate the hint that this, the hint concerning this law. So it's a natural association. You know very well when you take exams, if you have a matching question, you breathe a sigh of relief. Oh, Baruch Hashem, I don't have to think up the answers myself. All I have to do is match them, and all I have to do is find the best item on the list. I don't have to know it on my own. That's much easier than having to think it up on your own. This is a matching exercise. That's why the Ramchal actually calls it a remez. He calls it a hint. It's not in any sense a derivation. Yeah.
Wasn't the Vilna Gaon able to read out the oral teachings from the written?
I'm coming to that. Now, having yeah.
So basically, you wouldn't know why it said mos yimos.
If you didn't have the oral tradition, you'd have no clue why it says those words. That's correct.
And even though you do have the oral, you still don't know. It's just an association. You really don't know. Why would
the
Torah write double
Lashon,
Mos
Yimos? No. It's not Mos
Yimos,
it's Yumas Hameis. Yumas Hameis. Yeah, Mos Yimos is Yumas Hameis. Well, I don't know what the word why means here. There is a responsibility in Torah scholarship to link laws with verses. Now, if you know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants you to do this, he wants you to link the laws with the verses. And he writes the verses, writes the laws. And the only plausible link from law to verse is this law for this verse. Then you do know something about why it was written that way. It was written that way because when you're doing the linking scholarship, then you're going to link it to that law. So that is part of the reason it was written that way. Hadn't been written that way, you wouldn't be able to make that link. Now, in this connection, what are Rabbi Shmuel's 13 rules? 13 hermeneutical rules. It's a great title because nobody knows what a hermeneut is. And people get this also wrong. And Ramchal, in that same place that I told you, is explicit about this. They are not rules of deduction. What you hear when people look at those rules is, that's Talmudic logic. And in the secrecy of their own craniums, what they hear is, that means illogic. You know, when it says Talmudic logic, it's just not logical, right? So you have to get used to that because it's not logical. But it's not supposed to be logical. No Chinese literature expert and legal expert studying our text would dream of Gzeira Shava or Binyanav or Klal Prat and Klal Prat to Klal. He would never dream of those things. These are rules that the author of the text gave together with the text. And he said, listen to my vocabulary here because Rabbi Kaplan, when he translates those pages, gets this wrong. And it's very misleading. The author of the text said, I'm using this text to communicate with you. And I'm giving you rules whereby you will know what information I want to communicate with you. The word that's used in the Hebrew text there is kavana. Kavana means intention. By Kaplan translates meaning. Intention and meaning are two totally different concepts. A text cannot have an intention. Only an agent can have an intention. A text can have a meaning. But it cannot have an intention. And the word that's used there is kavanah, not mashma'ut, but kavanah. God says, I have an intention in communicating with you. You want to know what I'm intending to communicate with you? Use these 13 rules to reveal information coded in the text that I want you to have. It's not the meaning of the text at all. It's not the meaning of the text at all. It's just a code. Now, Rabbi Shmuel gave us those 13 rules which are used throughout the Talmud. There are many, many, many other rules. Rabbi Elazar gave 32 rules for narrative passages. And those are just the rules that are part of the general tradition. When you say the Gaon of Vilna had the ability to derive, it doesn't mean derive with logic. It means derive with rules that he knew that express what God intended us to be able to extract from the text. Not the meaning of the words, but the intended communication. Just as if, suppose God had said, all I want you to do is take the first letter of every word, string them together, forget the rest. Good, I would forget the rest. It wouldn't be relevant. He has to tell me what I'm supposed to get out of it. And if he would tell me, don't pay any attention to the literal meanings of the words, then I wouldn't pay any attention to it. We analyze the literal meaning of the text only because God said, this too is part of my communication. He said, oh, that's so? Okay, fine. So I'll look at the literal meaning also. The literal meaning is not superior to the other, not more fundamental, not more true. In many places, you get the attitude that the literal meaning is what it really says. And the rest of it is fluff. You know, people made it up. It's for entertainment and so forth and so on. Nothing can be further from the truth. Nothing can be further from the truth. What the purpose of the text is to communicate. The author has to tell you how it communicates. It's a little bit like someone who takes Shakespeare's plays and complain that the events described there never happened. So, well, that's true. They never happened. But so what? Shakespeare wasn't writing history. He was writing plays, which are supposed to reveal something real about human character and human interactions and thoughts and feelings. He wasn't supposed to be writing about real events. If you don't know that, you ain't getting it. Shakespeare's going to be lost on you. Same thing's true here. It's a text used for communication. Well, the author has to tell me, how is he communicating with this text? Since he does say that the literal meaning is part of the communication, so, thank you very much. I will now look at the literal meaning together with everything else. But it's not in any way superior to anything else. This is clear from the commentators. You read the commentators carefully. Anyway, so one element in the oral tradition is applying these rules to the text and deriving the information that God wants to communicate to us through the text via those rules. That's also part of the oral tradition. Though in a certain sense it falls into the middle section, and I sort of went over the boundary with this remark. Are we all together? Okay, that's what I wanted to tell you about the...
Are there allusions to the oral law in the written law without making assumptions that they couldn't be extrapolated to everyday communities?
Well... there is in that one in Deuteronomy 12:21 where it says, as I commanded you, and nowhere in the text is there any command. You have it a little bit like this. What would happen if a prophet comes before a community and says, if you do X, Y, Z, you're going to be punished? Now let's imagine that nowhere before him is there a command that you have to do X, Y, Z, or don't do X, Y, Z. Right? X, Y, Z is never mentioned before. Obviously, you have to assume that the community was aware of this and is being warned that if they violate it, they're going to be punished. Otherwise, why warn them if they violate it if they don't know anything about it? Right? That's how, by the way, laws... No, I'll just say this right because I'm running out of time. A prophet does not have the authority to create mitzvos. He cannot do that. How can the Talmud learn mitzvos from verses in the prophets? Only by this kind of presupposition. If the prophet says, if you do that, you're going to be punished, then obviously that was a law that they knew about. Right? Where did the law come from? Well, if it isn't written in the five books, then it was part of the oral tradition that came down from Moses. Right? So that's another way where you can see it's presupposed. But you know, it's a little funny. It's a little funny. The question that you ask, I think, is relevant to only a very unnatural situation. Let's say you have the rules of chess, right? Where is it written in the rules of chess that you can't take 6 hours per move? Well, it's not written, but then, you know, we're Americans, not British, and the British can play cricket for 5 days because that's because they're British. But, you know, the game's supposed to be a game that you play with a person. You know, it takes 6 hours per move. It'll take 7 years to play. You just don't do it that way. So where is it written in the rules? Well, any intelligent person who uses it knows that that's so. Now imagine you have a community of 3 million people, and it all comes together.
So we got it all together. We got it all together at the same time. So why should one half say that there's another half? You got it all at the same time. So only when you have a disconnected period and a period who are skeptical, when people are coming from the outside, this question arises. But for people who receive the information at the outset, it's a non-question.
Yeah, I understand it's implied. I was just wondering if there's any explicit allusions to it. I understand it wouldn't work without it.
There are incidents. For example, Aaron's two children are killed on the inauguration of the tabernacle, and he doesn't eat a certain sacrifice. And Moses reprimands him, and Aaron answers with a certain piece of logic, and Moses says, "You're right, I made a mistake." Right? So clearly there was some question there as to how to be understood, how to be applied, and they went through a piece of reasoning, and you know, so that kind of thing has to go on. You can't go on without it. Okay, we'll continue tomorrow. Session.
First shot.